Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We have two interesting stories for you on today's edition of As It Is. First, Christopher Jones Cruz joins us to talk about the life and controversy surrounding a man who is about to become a saint of the Catholic Church. Then some science and medical news, and it is good news for anyone who has diabetes. If you are ready to listen and learn, let's get started with part one. Pope Francis is making final preparations for his visit to the United States next week. During the trip, the Pope will officially recognize an 18th-century religious worker as a saint. Junípero Serra served as a Catholic missionary priest more than 200 years ago in what was then called Spanish California. Not everyone agrees that Father Serra should be recognized for his work. Among his biggest critics are Native Americans. Christopher Jones Cruz explains.
On September 23rd, in Washington, D.C., Pope Francis will complete a years-long process and recognize Junípero Serra as a saint. Father Serra helped create the Spanish colonial system of California missions. Spain had claimed most of California in the 16th century, but there were no Spanish settlements in the territory for nearly 200 years. In 1768, Spain's king, Charles III, decided the best way to keep the Spanish claim to California was to build settlements there. He ordered the creation of a series of small farming communities along the Pacific Ocean coast. But there was no one on the coast to begin the work. King Charles and his advisors decided that the farming settlements would begin with Roman Catholic churches called missions. The missions were places where Catholic clergymen taught the Christian religion to people who wanted to join the church. The king decided Catholic priests would build the missions and settlements with the help of Native Americans. The clergymen would teach the native people Christianity, the Spanish language, and how to farm. A religious group within the Catholic Church called the Franciscans would build the settlements. The Franciscans chose a young priest named Junípero Serra to begin the work. Many historians say the Spanish government and the Catholic Church could not have chosen a better person than Father Serra. He had always wanted to tell others about Christianity. In 1749, he sailed to Mexico to begin his life as a missionary. He spent several years studying the languages and customs of Mexico's native people. In 1768, Father Serra was given the job of building the first of the California missions near the present-day city of San Diego. But before the settlement was completed, Father Serra decided to move it. He did not like the way Spanish soldiers mistreated the Native Americans. He wanted to keep them separate. So he moved the mission to an area that is still called Mission Valley. Many people have criticized the mission system of settlements because it changed the way of life for the Native Americans in California. Critics say many Native Americans were forced to work at the missions. They say many were forced to become Christians, and many were badly treated by Spanish soldiers and died because of mistreatment or disease. Andrew Galvin is an American Indian and the head of the Mission Dolores Museum in San Francisco. Mr. Galvin admits that the mission system was not perfect, but he says he has respected the work of Father Serra since the 1970s.
I have worked along with the friars since that time promoting Father Serra's cause.
Vincent Medina also works at Mission Dolores Museum, but he says Father Serra should not be recognized as a holy man.
It's documented that he wanted the Indian languages suppressed. It's documented that he sent for whips, for Indian people to be whipped.
Mr. Medina says the Spanish brought disease to the native peoples and destroyed their culture. Father Serra worked at the Carmel Mission on the California coast, among other places. He is buried there. He is remembered there as a strong defender of the native Californians against the Spanish forces. Ruben Mendoza is an archaeologist at California State University, Monterey Bay. He has been studying Father Serra's life for 20 years. He was once a critic of the clergyman, but he has come to respect him.
And being of a Native American ancestry myself, Yaqui Indian, I don't give a pass to colonialism. On the other hand, when you look at the life of Serra very specifically, you will see that he was not only a man of his time, but he was a man well ahead of his time in that he was an advocate for Native peoples.
The Fernandeño Tatavium Band of Mission Indians is made up of tribes that lived near the California coast. Like many other Native Americans, they say Father Serra harmed Native peoples. But some of the tribe's Catholic members have defended him. Pope Francis has apologized for the way members of the church treated Native Americans. But he says some in the church worked to help them. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to the Voice of America. A diabetic woman no longer needs to take daily medicine after she received a stem cell transplant. The daily insulin injection had helped control the amount of sugar or glucose in her body. Wendy Peacock was first diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at age 17, according to the Miami Herald newspaper. Miss Peacock, who is now 43, received the stem cells in mid-August in a minimally invasive procedure at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine in Florida. Kelly Jean Kelly reports.
Doctors called the operation simple and said Ms. Peacock recovered quickly. After the operation, her body started producing insulin naturally. Ms. Peacock is now completely off insulin, one of her doctors said. These are the best results we've seen, said Dr. Camilo Ricordi, director of the Cell Transplant Center at the Diabetes Research Center in Florida. If these results can be confirmed, this can be the beginning of a new era in transplantation, said Dr. Ricordi. If other doctors study the results and confirm the outcome, the procedure could become available to other diabetics. Ms. Peacock says her life has changed dramatically as a result of the operation. Before the operation, Ms. Peacock was unable to sense when her blood glucose dropped dangerously. Low glucose can make a person confused or unconscious. It may even lead to death. Now, she does not need to monitor her blood glucose. As any type 1 knows, you live on a very structured schedule, Ms. Peacock explained. I do a mental checklist every day in my head, glucose tabs, food, glucometer, etc., and then I stop and say, wow, I don't have to plan that anymore. Asians will find the medical news encouraging. Studies have shown that Asians are at higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes when compared with people of European ancestry. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Many people fear a visit to the dentist. They are not so much afraid of the doctor, but of the dental equipment and treatments. Well, fear no more. A British company says it has developed technology that will end the need for mechanical cleaning of dental cavities. It also says the technology speeds up a natural process of tooth repair. For over a century, dentists have been repairing cavities the same way. They first remove the decayed or bad tooth tissue with an electric-powered drill. Then they fill the hole in the bone with a metallic or plastic substance. If the cavity is not too deep, the experience can be unpleasant. However, if it is deep, near the nerve of the tooth, it can be very painful. The worst part is that the process of drilling and filling the cavity has to be repeated for the entire life of that tooth. Rebecca Moezes is a senior lecturer at King's College London. She says that this cycle lasts the rest of the tooth's life.
You're really in that cycle of repair and replacement for the rest of the tooth's life.
Tooth enamel is what we see on the outside of the tooth. The enamel of a damaged tooth can be replaced naturally. This process is called remineralization. But it is too slow to stop bacteria from building up in small, narrow areas of the enamel. A British business called Reminova has developed a method for speeding up this natural remineralization of early-stage cavities. Jeff Wright is head of the company.
And we've just found a way to make that a much faster process, driving healthy calcium and phosphate minerals into your enamel, and through a natural process it will bind on and add to the enamel that's there.
The process begins with a cleaning of the cavity. This does not require power tools. The dentist covers the problem area with a mineral solution and then uses an electrical current to harden this material. The electricity is too weak for the patient to feel, and the hardened mineral completely fills the cavity. Researchers say this method could be especially useful for children. Sometimes children have bad experiences at the dentist. They fear the drilling and injections. Who wouldn't be afraid? Better experiences as a child might lead to more visits to the dentist as an adult. Dr. Barry Quinn works as a consultant at King's College.
If children have a better experience of going to the dentist, so they haven't had the necessary drilling and injections for routine fillings, then they'll be much more positive in later life and probably become much more regular patients.
Dentists say the new method is most effective on early-stage cavities. The whole treatment lasts about as long as a normal drill-and-fill visit. Researchers say they believe the new method can be further developed for treating late-stage cavities. And they are quick to note that regular cleaning with fluoride toothpaste helps prevent cavities in the first place, And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about the War of 1812 between the United States and Britain. In the summer of 1814, the two countries opened peace talks at Ghent in Belgium. But Britain was in no hurry to agree on a peace treaty. This week, we tell the story of how the war ended. British forces were planning several campaigns in the United States in the autumn and winter of 1814. Successful military campaigns could force the United States to accept the kind of treaty Britain wanted. British representatives to the talks demanded that the United States give control of its Northwest Territory to the Indians. They also asked that the United States give part of the state of Maine to Canada and make other changes in the border. The Americans made equally tough demands. The United States wanted payment for damages suffered during the war. It also wanted the British to stop seizing American sailors for the British Navy. And the United States wanted all of Canada. The British representatives said they could not even discuss the question of stopping impressment by Americans into the British Navy, and the Americans would surrender none of their territory. Most of America's representatives had little hope the talks would succeed. But then Britain received word that its military campaigns had failed at Baltimore and Plattsburgh. After that, the British representatives became easier to negotiate with. They dropped their demands for American territory. The Americans then dropped their demands for Canadian territory. The issues that had led to the war no longer existed. Britain's war with France had caused the British and French to interfere with neutral American trade. And Britain had needed men for its navy. Now the war with France was over. No longer was there any reason to interfere with the trade of any nation. And no longer was there any need to seize Americans for service in the British Navy. On December 24th, the day before Christmas in 1814, the United States and Britain signed a simple treaty. Each side agreed to stop fighting. They also agreed to settle all their differences at future negotiations. The war had ended, but one more battle was to be fought before news of the peace treaty reached the United States. During the autumn of 1814, British soldiers at Jamaica began preparing for an attack against New Orleans, a city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. Late in November, this force of about 7,500 men sailed from Jamaica to New Orleans. The British soldiers were commanded by General Edward Pakenham. The general did not take his men directly to the mouth of the Mississippi River. Instead, they sailed across a lake east of the city. Early during the afternoon of December 23rd, General Andrew Jackson the commander of American forces at New Orleans, learned that the British force was near. General Jackson was a good soldier and a great leader. He fought in the Revolutionary War, then studied law. He moved west to Nashville, Tennessee. The general also served in both houses of the United States Congress. When war broke out in 1812, he was elected general of a group of volunteer soldiers from Tennessee. Jackson was a rough man. His soldiers feared and respected him. They called him Old Hickory because he seemed as tough as hickory wood. Jackson was given responsibility for defending the coast along the Gulf of Mexico. Earlier in the year, he had attacked Pensacola in Florida and forced out several hundred British Marines. Jackson believed the British would attack Mobile before attacking New Orleans. He left part of his forces at Mobile and took the others to the mouth of the Mississippi. Jackson was a sick man when he got to New Orleans, and what he found made him feel no better. Little had been done to prepare for the expected British attack. Jackson declared martial law and began building the city's defenses. Most of the work on the defenses had been completed when Jackson got word that the British were only a few kilometers from New Orleans. "Gentlemen," Jackson told his officers, "the British are below. We must fight them tonight." The British soldiers rested. They believed it would be easy to capture the city the next day. But Jackson rushed up guns and men and attacked the British by surprise just after dark. Then the Americans retreated to a place about 8 kilometers south of the city. Jackson had chosen this place carefully. On the right was the Mississippi River. On the left was the mud and water of a swamp that could not easily be crossed. In front of the American soldiers was an open field. For 2 weeks, the British soldiers waited. They tested the American defenses at several places, but found no weaknesses. Every day, Jackson had his men improve their positions. At night, small groups of Jackson's soldiers would slip across the field and silently attack British soldiers guarding the other side. Finally, on January 8th, the British attacked. They expected the Americans to flee in the face of their strong attack, but the Americans stood firm. Jackson's artillery fired into the enemy. When the British got as close as 150 meters, the Americans began to fire their rifles. The rain of bullets and shells was deadly. General Pakenham was wounded twice and then killed by a shell that exploded near him. Only one British soldier reached the top of the American defenses. The British finally retreated. They left behind more than 2,000 dead and wounded. 500 other British soldiers had been captured. 13 Americans were killed. It was a great victory for the United States, but one that was not necessary. The war had ended by treaty 2 weeks earlier. Historian Alan Taylor says the peace treaty saved the United States from a very grim situation.
The United States government was bankrupt. It had lost its credit. and it could not raise enough in taxes for the war effort, and most creditors were refusing to lend any more money to the United States. And so it was very unclear how the Americans would conduct another campaign in 1815, because it looked like they wouldn't have the money for it.
The Senate acted quickly to approve the treaty. On February 17, 1815, President Madison declared the war officially ended. It had lasted 2 years and 8 months and united the American people. On the 4th of July in 1815, the nation celebrated its 39th anniversary of independence. In Washington, the man who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key, spoke at the celebrations. Historian Alan Taylor says many people call the War of 1812 America's second war for independence, but he calls it America's first civil war. He says the country had been divided throughout the war, but things changed after Andrew Jackson's victory at New Orleans.
And so Americans then concluded that the war had really been a glorious occasion that had defended national honor and proved the merit of their republican institutions. And they were so relieved by all of this that they decided to celebrate the war in their memories.
Albert Gallatin, Madison's Treasury Secretary and one of the negotiators at Ghent, said people felt more American after the war. They feel and act more like a nation. Alan Taylor says the War of 1812 was very difficult for the United States, yet Americans remember it as a feel-good war. At the same time, he says, the War of 1812 also united Canadians.
Despite all of their divisions during the war, they felt so relieved that they had fended off American invasion that they remembered the war as a glorious victory over the more powerful United States.
As a result of the war, Alan Taylor says both Americans and Canadians felt a greater sense of nationalism. And because of that, the two nations could relate more peacefully. Each believed it could survive without having to defeat the other.
And today, Canada and the United States are each other's primary trade and security partner in the world.
But not everyone benefited from the end of the war. The opposition Federalist Party found itself greatly embarrassed by the peace. Its leaders had long denounced the war and said Britain could not be defeated. Many of the Federalists had traded with the enemy. Some had worked with the British against their own country. They had even threatened to break up the Union. Once the war was over, the Federalist Party lost its supporters. And then the party itself soon disappeared, even in the New England states, its base of support. The end of the Federalist Party changed politics in the United States. The changes started as early as the next presidential election in 1816. James Madison continued the tradition begun by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson of serving only 8 years as president. The man who followed him will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.